This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Attempting to explain yesterday's market plunge, and California lawmakers acquire a long-lost superpower, taxation. From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. It's the 8th of November. Happy Thursday. We'll also check in on the start of the once-a-decade change in leadership in China. We'll look at Barack Obama's prospects next to other notable two-termers, Reagan, Clinton, and Bush the Younger. And we'll update you on the first known orc to seek public office in the United States.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
After yesterday's market plunge, I think we've all been anxious to see what Wall Street has in store today. The major stock indexes yesterday all fell nearly 2.5%, the biggest sell-off of the year. With me now, we've got Susan Schmidt. She's Managing Director of U.S. Value Equities at Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Welcome back to Marketplace.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning.
Susan, some folks were inclined to blame Europe for what we saw yesterday. Of course, we also had, you know, some other stuff going on here. What do you think?
Well, I think Europe had nothing to do with it. I think Europe is on a permanent rerun. It's a story that we keep seeing, and we've seen it before. It's going to continue for the next couple months. Yesterday, to me, was all about our elections and the market's concern over our politicians and their ability to be able to find a compromise regarding the upcoming fiscal cliff.
I thought we were also anxious for some certainty on Wall Street after this election. Wasn't this certainty?
No, in fact, that's exactly what we didn't get, because now we saw a quite a big divide between the parties. And while we have, there's no clear winner from the election. President Obama stays in office, but the problem doesn't get resolved. We didn't see any significant change with the comments the politicians were making yesterday that gave the market confidence that a reconciliation would happen between the two, and we'd have some resolution to potentially cut back on these draconian perceived spending cuts that might push us back into a recession. And that's the big fear.
The fiscal cliff, of course. We'll keep talking about it. No doubt. Susan Schmidt, Managing Director of U.S. Value Equities with Mesirow Financial. Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's check in on Wall Street and do the numbers. Markets are down this morning, but no repeat of yesterday's plunge. The Dow and the S&P 500 are both down around 1/3%. The NASDAQ at this hour is down about 0.5%. The slowing global economy hit McDonald's in October. The Golden Arches saw worldwide sales fall for the first time since 2003. U.S. jobless claims fell last week, but officials caution against reading too much into those numbers since the storm could have kept folks from filing in the Northeast. And the U.S. trade deficit got smaller in September. U.S. exports held up better than many economists had expected. Here's some more numbers for you. President Obama set some interesting milestones with his reelection. No president since the Great Depression has been reelected with unemployment this high at 7.9%. He's only the second to be awarded a second term with unemployment over 7%. The other, since the Great Depression, was Ronald Reagan. Couple good facts there to set up this week's attitude check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Attitude Check is our weekly partnership with Gallup and Editor-in-Chief Frank Newport. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So let's put President Obama in the context of other recent presidents who were starting their second terms, Reagan, Clinton, and George W. Bush.
Well, I would think of those three, the two that Obama would want to emulate would be Reagan and Bill Clinton, because when it was all over, they ended up with job approval ratings in the 60% range as they left office. And George W. Bush, ended up with a 34% job approval rating when he left office. So of the three that have been reelected before him, President Obama probably wants to emulate the first two. He's actually not in as quite a good position as they were. For example, job approval-wise, Reagan was at a 58 and Clinton at a 54 as they got reelected. And Obama's latest job approval rating we have is at 52%. So he's a little weaker, but not that much weaker than they were.
And Frank, now that we can finally take a breath, what would you say Gallup learned from this latest round of polling and the election?
Well, we learned that polling still works. There's been a lot of talk about polling fading in terms of its accuracy because of cell phones and the internet and a lot of other ways that you assess what people are thinking and feeling, like analyzing Twitter posts and Facebook posts and all that. But old-fashioned polling across the board from most firms this time actually ended up being the best way to gauge what was happening out there and looked like it was pretty accurate.
Anything constructive, though, that you take away from it that you'll think about tweaking or changing for next time?
Well, we're always looking for ways to improve. And, of course, one of the big challenges is cell phones and the fact that people don't communicate as much by voice as they have in the past. And so looking at that, we're going to have to figure out how to continue to handle that going forward. Likely voters. Gallup has a likely voter model that we've been using for many years. But I think Obama's people actually turned out in somewhat higher numbers than might have been anticipated based on the way that we've analyzed that historically. And that may have a lot to do with the mechanical ground game that the Obama people were able to put into effect. So we'll analyze again how we isolate likely voters, because that's a real key to trying to figure out who's going to actually vote and how they're going to vote on Election Day.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup. Thanks as always, Frank.
My pleasure.
In his victory speech Tuesday night, President Obama mentioned climate change. And as Scott Tong reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that has the energy industry wondering what is on the agenda of the Environmental Protection Agency.
EPA has a busy to-do list, none of which requires Congress to act, writing new rules on sulfur in gasoline, ozone emissions, and pollution from cement plants. Perhaps the biggie concerns power plants and their greenhouse gas emissions. They make up 40% of the national footprint. Elliot Duringer is with the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions.
They got a little bit of a pass from the environmental movement, but now with the election behind us, there will be very strong pressure on the administration to move forward with those regulations.
The coal industry is opposed, saying it will doom coal plants. But Brandon Blossman at Tudor Pickering Holt says coal's big problem is competition. It's losing business to cheap natural gas.
The loss of market share has really put a lot of pressure on demand for domestic power generation coal.
In the president's first term, the EPA was accused of stalling and had signed a settlement promising the power plant rules. Now, the president's reelection may free the agency to proceed with political certainty. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The Chinese Communist Party convened its 18th Party Congress today. Lasts about a week. The event will end with President Hu Jintao handing power to China's next leader. The transition is being closely watched all over the world, in part because of the implications for China's economy. Earlier today, the BBC's John Sudworth in Beijing talked with my Marketplace Morning Report colleague Jeremy Hobson. Here's Jeremy.
So, John, what is being said today about what's next for China?
Well, this is the end of Hu Jintao's decade in power, and one part of his speech was to mark the successes of the past 5 years and also setting out a sort of roadmap for the challenges that lie ahead. The crowning achievement, as this generation of leadership see it, of course, is China's economic success, the boom years, the lifting of millions of people out of poverty. But in a sense, that has been growth at all costs, and they now realise that there are serious challenges, not just environmental, but challenges relating to social issues too, and in particular corruption. We heard Hu Jintao mention that issue a number of times in the speech today, and he even went as far as saying that if the issue isn't dealt with properly, it could lead to the collapse of the party and the end of the Chinese state.
Well, do you think that with the next leader of China, we will see dramatic changes in how the Chinese economy works?
I don't think we'll see dramatic changes in policy. In many ways, this isn't the first time we've heard this call for reform from China's senior leadership. And all too often, the rhetoric simply isn't matched by reality. If anything, Hu Jintao's decade in power has been marked by a ratcheting up of control and surveillance. China now spends more on internal security than it does on its national defense. And I think on the economy, too, we'll see continuity. We'll see the same sorts of policies, except for one thing. They are trying to change the model of growth, to move from a model based on big government spending and investment to one based on the cash in people's pockets, to try to awaken China's domestic consumer demand. But they've spoken about that before, and it's easier said than done.
The BBC's John Sudworth in Beijing. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure, Jeremy.
Just another quick China sidebar here. It's never been easy to become a commercial airline pilot, nor should it be, really. But in China, Hainan Airlines has introduced a new requirement for its recruits: body odor. The Shenzhen News says Hainan candidates with discernible BO will be dismissed immediately. Photos show pilot recruiters sniffing the armpits of would-be pilots, and that inspired me to draft this little slogan for them. I hope they like it. Hainan Airlines, nothing special in the air.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Sprint has announced that it is buying the customers of U.S. Cellular, which is a big provider in the Midwest. The investment will boost Sprint's capacity there. And this week, AT&T announced it will invest $14 billion over the next 3 years to beef up its wireless and broadband services. Seems like good news for wireless customers, but it could also be bad news if you're a fan of the old-fashioned landline phone. Here's Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff.
It was just a generation ago that landlines were king, and AT&T encouraged callers to
reach out and touch someone.
Now, a third of the country has gone cell phone only, and many others are getting their landlines from cable companies or fiber optic connections. So AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson told investors yesterday that the company eventually wants out of the traditional business.
We plan to begin an aggressive transition away from legacy TDM technology.
AT&T is asking the Federal Communications Commission to look into new rules that would let it move beyond the outdated and less profitable wires. Susan Crawford teaches law at Harvard.
With one hand, they're saying, look, we'll invest. With the other hand, they're saying to the FCC, if you don't deregulate us implicitly, we will never invest again.
She'd like to see the government require modern lines for most everyone. AT&T sees a future where customers get a combination of wireless and broadband. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Now, along with the Democratic gains at the national level in the election this week, it brought some big changes to state legislatures. Democrats took control of both houses in Maine as well as in Minnesota. Democrats now control all of state government in Minnesota for the first time in 20 years. Democrats also took back the houses in Colorado, New Hampshire, and Oregon, and they took back the Senate in New York. In California, voters beefed up Democrats to a two-thirds majority, called a supermajority, in both the Assembly and the Senate. That's a situation California hasn't seen since 1933, and it has some important implications. John Myers is a longtime political reporter in California, now political editor for KXTV in Sacramento. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
So, a supermajority, most likely, in California. What can, in theory, be done with that?
Well, a lot of things can be done here. I mean, unlike a lot of other states that pretty much give the majority the power of governing in all ways, California has always required this absolute supermajority for the most complicated things in governing, most notably raising taxes. And what we've got here with the Democrats in the California legislature apparently winning a supermajority of each house of that body is effectively we've given them all the tools of government. We haven't taken a few tools out of that toolbox. We've given them everything.
I have seen people in the California press quoting from Spider-Man here, I guess, with great power comes great responsibility. What do you think? Are a bunch of new taxes on the way now or what?
I don't think we're going to see that. I think the governor has been adamant that he ran on this return to Sacramento in 2010 with a promise of no new taxes unless the voters approve them. But I think it depends on how you define taxes, too, because in California, we've got a number of ways that revenue can come into the state budget, whether they are through imposed fees, whether it's closing of tax credits, what some people call tax loopholes. I don't know if all those things qualify under the definition of going to the voters, but I do think the Democrats have got a lot of power now to work on it.
What effect do you expect this might have sort of within the Democrats in California?
I think that's going to be the really fascinating part. I know that people across the nation look at California as this ultra blue state. We're really a lot more purple. But even among Democrats, there's not uniformity. And I think that has been missed because of the way we've governed over the last few years. I think with a supermajority in the state house in Sacramento, you're going to see different factions of Democrats having to find a way to bridge their differences. There are a lot of flavors that haven't necessarily been highlighted before. Having this much power, I think, will bring that out.
Is there some belief you sense that just the supermajority itself could be crucial to helping the state get its finances into line?
I think it's going to definitely present a new chapter in that long-running saga about California's finances. I mean, you saw right after the election Standard & Poor's giving us a thumbs up for the tax initiative that Governor Brown pushed forward on the ballot, Proposition 30. I think in large part because they saw that as a stability for the next few years. I think should we have more financial problems, and we certainly do, we have structural problems with California governance. Now having Democrats having all of that power is going to make it easier for them to change things. The question is, of course, what do you get, and is it good? I think that remains to be seen.
John Myers, political editor with ABC affiliate KXTV in Sacramento. Thanks.
Thank you.
And finally, voters, of course, handed Barack Obama four more years and tilted Congress a bit more toward the Democrats. Lesser known is that voters also elected the first orc. Colleen Lukovich was running for state senate in Maine when her opponent, and more specifically the Republican Party, I guess, decided to make an issue of her online gaming hobby. Specifically, Lukovich Online is a green-skinned level 85 orc assassin with quite a mohawk in World of Warcraft. Suffice it to say, though, the attack was repelled and the orc emerged victorious. Now, critics suspecting sorcery at work here might continue to make something of her vote total, though, which I happened to notice this morning was 8666. I'm Jeff Horwich, and that's it for the Marketplace Midday Update for today. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.